Bill 2407. Anybody want to testify on House Bill 2407? Seen nobody. Close the public hearing. Open a work session on House Bill 2407. Colleagues, we have amendments. Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2407. Charity, do you want to tell us what it does? Or I'm happy to handle that.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Basically, the amendments to House Bill 2407 make a successor retirement system for legislators. It's a fixed contribution system of 6%. It's defined contribution. It allows for members to roll over their PERS accounts. The payment for the administrative costs come from the contributions of members and or earnings. And the Legislative Administration Committee is to contract with one or more private providers. So assuming that there are more than one that want to have 90 legislators in a plan, then you will have a choice. And this would look very much like the optional retirement plan that currently is in existence now. And I believe that's pretty much it for this particular amendment. And we have a fiscal on the original bill. The fiscal actually, to be honest, will save money because the current budget amount to go into PERS is significantly more than 6% for legislators. And Dallas is tracking that down right now because we just got the amendment. But the cost to start it up, I think, is there at the bottom. It would be very minimal, maybe $6,500 to do an RFP to the various plans. And with that, colleagues, I would take a motion on the amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
I would move the Dash 4 amendments to 2407 be adopted.
Representative Brown has moved that Dash 4 amendments be adopted, House Bill 2407. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, so ordered. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
I would move House Bill 2407 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Brown has moved House Bill 2407 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation. Is there discussion now? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to confirm what's the status if 2407 becomes law to those folks who happen to serve for a few years in the state legislature in between other public service jobs? Is it my understanding that they would roll out their existing account into the private pension, including all of their existing PERS?
Representative Butler, it would be at their option to do so. They could leave that account in PERS. However, for terms starting after, I believe it is it July or January? One of
January.
January? We'll confirm that, but in July 4th, or a 2004 date, July 1, 2004 date, any term after that, you would start in a new system. So essentially, you would have two pension systems unless you wanted to roll your money over, which you could under this bill. I don't know if people would or not, but it would certainly be at their option.
I just wanted to make certain, Mr. Chair, that we wouldn't discourage folks from taking opportunities out from other service if they were substantially vested, or those folks who may desire to just serve for very short periods of time in the legislature and move in and out so that we don't have a lifetime job that we're trying to create a pension for. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to comment that this is not an issue that I have a personal stake in because I have elected not to participate in the PERS system, but I think that this is a good approach generally to enhance the credibility of the process we're in here, because we're going to be working on some difficult issues over coming weeks and having it clear that the members of the Legislative Assembly don't stand to gain in this process. I think is an important dimension of the credibility that we need to establish, and I'd like to applaud the leadership of various members of the committee, including the chair and also Representative Barker, who introduced one of the other vehicles we had before us and put forward the concept that it was inconsistent with our responsibilities here to be participating in the system that we oversee. And I think this is a good direction to go, and I applaud all those who had a hand in it.
Thank you. Anyone else? I know there's two schools of thought, and one is just that legislators shouldn't have a pension at all. And I am sympathetic and would actually vote for that if it were to occur. I think some of our colleagues would probably see it somewhat differently. And I would say that I think this accomplishes what we needed to, which removes any inherent conflict of interest of us overseeing and being part of a PERS plan, especially at the police and fire rate that we currently are, for those who are in the system, and gives them the opportunity to get out and move over to a new system. I think it's it sends the right signal, and I know some would not want to go this far, but I believe, quite frankly, that it's necessary. I think we need to lead by example, and therefore I believe the legislature ought to go first, and that we should be in a new system. And I think this is reasonable. It actually will save a fair amount of money for the legislative budget, which we'll likely need to save since we'll probably be cutting from where we are now in the 03-05 budget. So I would encourage folks to vote for it and to advocate for it among your colleagues, knowing that there are some who are going to be uncomfortable moving out of the current system that we're in. Anyone else?
Mr. Chair, just one final comment, if I may. I've mentioned this to one other person outside of the building, outside the process, and their sole comment to me about legislators pulling out of PERS and bailing out of PERS, they said, "Why does this make me envision rats jumping off of a ship?" And I said, I didn't know that that's what we were doing, but I'll make your comment be known.
Well, and I appreciate that, and in no way do I see this as legislators bailing off a sinking ship. What I see this as is removing a conflict of interest and correcting, I think, something that should have happened a long time ago. As we all know, if you are a legislator and you're in PERS and you stay here a large number of years, your pension is likely to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 to $150 a month. And I'm sure that there are legislators who could vouch for that. I know that there are others who have gone on to other jobs or had other jobs and do much better than that. But the truth is, I think at this time of austerity for our state budget, it's important that we send the right signal to the public. And I think the signal ought to be that legislators will no longer have a conflict of interest, that they will be in a separate private plan, and that it will cost less than it currently does. And I think those are all appropriate messages to send to the public and to save money. Anyone else? Dennis?
I'd like to just mention on the record that if we were to stay in PERS very shortly, the cost to the state government for each of us would be over 20% toward our PERS retirement because of the unfunded actuarial liability. And that this plan sets up a 6% contribution, and so we're cutting by almost three-fourths because it will soon be 22.8% and climb from there. And so we're saving the state, although it's not a tremendous amount of money in dollars because there's not a great number of legislators, the percentages are great. And I think it sets an example, and people should understand that what we're doing is taking a much less expensive retirement plan for the legislature in the future.
Thank you. And, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just would like to say, although I retired out of a different system than PERS public system, it was always an annoyance to me from the time I learned that the legislature was drawing the higher rate, the police and fire rate, which never made any sense to me, having served 31 years in uniform as a police officer in Oregon. So I'm glad that we're moving this along and coming up with a different plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Aye.
Representative Maury.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Nolan.
Excuse.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Chairman Hope.
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2407 as amended will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the chair will carry the bill. We will close the work session on House Bill 2407 and move to 2773. Open a public hearing on 2773 and call Commissioner Leslie Lewis, former state representative from Newburgh.
Well,
McMinnville?
Carlton? Yeah.
I knew I was in the neighborhood.
Okay, you too, Lee.
Good afternoon, Chair Knopf and committee members. I'm Leslie Lewis, and as Chair Knopf said, I am currently a Yamhill County Commissioner. I am coming to you today to ask that you pass House Bill 2773. My reason for asking this is that our county has become increasingly concerned about the escalating contribution rates for the PERS system. While our rates are not as bad as the rates we were just discussing, our rates this year are going to be close to 18% of payroll. These increasing costs are resulting in layoffs and reduced services to our citizens in Yamhill County. As an elected official, I want the opportunity to cease being an active member in the PERS system. As the law now stands, once you are a PERS member, you cannot elect to become inactive. And House Bill 2773 would simply give an elected official the ability to become an inactive member. The provisions of this bill are strictly voluntary and apply only to elected officials. So I think it should be a fairly uncontroversial piece of legislation. And I would strongly urge your passage of House Bill 2773. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Questions? Representative McPherson.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to understand Commissioner Lewis. I see the language which says any elected official may elect any time to cease to be an active member of the public employee retirement system. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how that relates to people who then are first elected, their first experience or opportunity to be part of the system is upon an election. Does it mean that this would not relate to somebody who is elected initially and then has a choice whether to be in or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that's an excellent question. Actually, currently as an elected official, you do have an option at the time you are sworn into your elected position. You have an option of becoming a member of PERS or not. And I would say that during the time that I was a legislator, just as you have done, I did not ever become a member of PERS. But when I left the legislature and moved into county government, I was leaving a job where I had a retirement system. The only retirement system that the county had available was PERS, and I signed on to it. That was 2 years ago, and I must say I deeply regret it. The county, while it would be a small amount of money, the county would save money by my not being in PERS. And there may, in fact, be other elected officials in the state of Oregon in county government or in other local government that would like the option of removing themselves from PERS. Again, if you're a brand new elected official, you already can opt out. But once you are in, there is currently no way to get out. And that's what I would like to have the option to do would be to cease to become an active member.
Under this language, an election to get out is irrevocable. If one is initially eligible, and as you did and I have done, elect not to be in, mm-hmm. is that an irrevocable decision?
It is. As long as I was in the legislature, as I understood it, when I was in the legislature and I opted out of PERS, I believe that was irrevocable. I don't believe I could have gotten back, and maybe Representative Canope would correct me. I never even looked into it. I opted out my freshman year and never even looked into it. But I believe it was irrevocable. That's our understanding currently at the county level. If an elected official, brand new elected official, comes in and they opt out, I don't believe they ever have an opportunity to opt back in. So I believe that's the current situation.
I suppose I probably should have known the consequences of my own election more effectively than I did, but you've given me some good pension advice.
Okay.
Steve Delaney, you want to come up and shed a little light on that just to confirm?
Somebody who knows the answer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just a little clarification on the way this statute does work. From Representative Lewis, is correct that there is an opportunity when an individual first takes office to make an election. It's an affirmative election. There is a form that one signs and sends into PERS, and you're given 30 days from the time you take office to make that election. You would get another opportunity if you did not take that election under current statute and rule. If you did not take the opportunity to make that election when you're first elected, upon a re-election, you would again be given the opportunity to decide whether or not you wished either to elect now and begin PERS or to discontinue. You could at that point choose to discontinue your PERS, but only at that point of re-election. This bill would allow a person during their term of office to stop the election, which currently is not provided for within statute. As far as irrevocability of the whole issue, generally, if a person does not take advantage of the opportunity to elect PERS during a given term, it's lost until that next term of office, with occasional exceptions provided by the legislature. The legislature I got the dates here, in 1975, 1979, 1981, and 1989, provided opportunities for elected officials and legislators who had not previously elected PERS to go back and purchase those periods of time that they missed out on by not having taken advantage of those opportunities. And there were windows of time you had to do it at that point or you lost that opportunity. So
that's the
you
reason
never
for
say
the last
never.
Bill.
Mr. Chair, this is an observation, is that it's a technical point, but the way this bill works, somebody who gets into the system as an elected official and then elects out, that's an irrevocable decision. What I'm just hearing from Mr. Delaney is that for a person who declines participation, that is not an irrevocable decision. It's they can affect at any later time as they come into, as they get reelected even to the same office, they would have that opportunity opened up to them again. And it's a kind of a technical point, but it's like an inconsistency that doesn't have a lot of justification to it.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I was advised by legislative counsel that this is the way they needed to draft this bill. So, I'm not an attorney, and maybe there are some finer points that we missed here. But I would say I'm personally satisfied with the bill as it is. I mean, if once I get out, I would just assume it'd be irrevocable.
Well, we could certainly have legislative counsel take up that question and see if there's an issue of continuity for that particular part of this bill. Any other questions? Steve, did you have anything else?
No, Mr. Chair, that pretty much follows the basic context I was going to provide as far as current statute.
Okay. Thank you. Is that it? Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2773? Jim Green?
Nothing, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We will... close the public hearing on House Bill 2773. I think hold it over and just for comfort level of committee members, just take a look at that particular clause and see if that's the way it really ought to be. Honestly, committee, I don't have a problem with people who want to opt out of the system and leave the system for whatever reason to be able to do that, especially elected officials. Obviously, there's a significant issue. Representative Butler.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, I fear, based upon what the calculations that we've seen, based upon those folks who are covered versus those that are not covered on BERS, on public employee payrolls, that the amount, one would say, if my salary was $50,000 from that public entity, and our assessment rate for that public entity is going up to 20%, that we're going to save that public entity a full $10,000. Unfortunately, that's not the case. The rest of the public, or the rest of the covered payroll of that public entity, just has a small bump in the balance of their rates. And what happens is that, yes, there will be a small savings, but it won't be the $10,000 that you might have otherwise thought. It might be a few hundred dollars, and that's the concern that I've got of folks that say, well, I'm going to jump out, and a small county, a very small county's payroll will amount to a few millions of dollars. And unfortunately, that's what it costs to run government locally on small counties and city scale, and so that few dollars, or that few fractions of a percentage point, spread over that larger payroll, the balance of the covered payroll, normally absorbs and picks up the amount that an elected official, believing that they were doing something that was really good for the employing entity, basically hasn't done anything other than just shift that cost to the balance of the covered employees. So it's a very hard situation at very best, but laudable.
Maybe we could create a new system for them to roll their money over into, and they could sever their
I think you said contracts. Before, Mr. Chair, once again proving that nothing with regard to BERS is simple.
Oh, you got that right. Well, thank you, and let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2003. We've got dueling letters today, and we also have Mary Botkin signed up. So both Greg Hartman and Bill Gehry have authored letters to the committee this week. So we will, yes.
And with that introduction,
you can come on up. And I hope you all receive those. They're kind of an interesting read. I believe Mr. Gehry would like to come in on Tuesday and talk about his. Unfortunately, he's out of town right at the moment. So we'll allow him the opportunity to do that, because I think he has done a little bit of research on the issue and had some points that I think he wanted to make regarding the legislative council letter that circulated. Mary Botkin.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome on this wonderful Thursday afternoon.
It's actually, for the moment, a lovely day out there. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Botkin, and I'm here representing 21,000 public employees that are members of the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, ABSME Council 75. I know this comes as a great shock to you, but we are here today to speak against House Bill 2003. And I've given you written comments, and so I'm not going to read those comments verbatim. You all are smart enough to do that on your own. So I'll summarize the comments kind of in two or three sections. First of all, we think that legal counsel Greg Chamoff is absolutely correct in his opinion, and of course you would expect that we would agree with that since his opinion agrees with ours. Our opinion, however, has not been driving his, but rather his and his predecessors have driven ours. Greg Chamoff is not the first member of the Legislative Council team to say that there are contract rights and that contract rights are inviolate. And you know, Kathleen Buffet said it before him, and Tom Clifford said it before that, and at the risk of sounding like a smart aleck, and I don't mean to, no is no is no. And I remember telling my child when he was young, honey, I don't care how you structure the question, the answer is still no. Part of our concern about House Bill 2003 is, and please correct me if I am misunderstanding the purpose, but it seems to me that part of the purpose of the bill is to put into statute the Judge Lipscomb decision, which is under appeal. And you know, I'm not a certified smart person. I'm not a lawyer, thank you very much. You know, never wanted to be one. But I thought that when you had issues before the courts, you ought to let the courts decide so that when we fix the law, we fix it in a way that agrees with what the courts have decided. And that to kind of inject the legislative opinion in the middle of a court case is kind of like injecting different levels of government and different branches of government into other governmental decisions. And maybe I've just got this all wrong, but, you know, it just seems to me like you have, at this point, we've kind of moved beyond the legislative branch, and now we have the administrative and the judicial branch kind of interacting with each other. And I don't know how you all win with that. I mean, it would seem to me like we ought to just let the judicial branch finish their work and then legislate that decision and codify it. Win, lose, or draw. I mean, it just seems like that's the process we ought to use. I'm really concerned, we are really concerned about the elimination of the employee match for a variety of reasons, or the employee contributions. One of the reasons that we're most concerned about it is because historically, I suspect that if this is successful and the employees quit contributing to their retirement, even for a period of time or forever, that once you all have gone on to bigger and better points in your careers, I'm still going to be in this building. And at some point, I'm going to be trying to explain why the employees no longer make any contribution towards their own retirement. And I'll be talking about Greg McPherson's four statements, and I'll be talking about, you know, Chair Canope. And, you know, unfortunately, I'm not in PERS. I never had the option of getting into PERS, and I can assure you if I had that option, I'd be in it tomorrow morning. So I will be here after many of you have gone, because my 401k will not support my family and I in retirement. And, you know, whatever. There's another kind of structural question that I have about this whole about the whole employee contribution. We have this in contracts all over the state of Oregon. So I look at Section 36, I think it was, that says we're going to open the contracts. We're going to require contract reopeners. I don't think we can do that. And I don't think you can do that as a legislative body. And I can assure you that, you know, my organization, for one, will challenge your right to do that if you do that. And I'm concerned about my colleagues who are suddenly going to have 105 contracts open. And we now have under 750, we have compressed contract bargaining guidelines and timelines. I don't know physically how these folks are going to do this in the compressed constraints of timelines under bargaining with the potential of having 150 contracts all open to renegotiate the employee contributions. I just don't know how. I'm just talking about structurally, I don't know how that will work. And Representative Barker, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, you've sat at the bargaining table. Maybe you can explain to me. It's been a long time since I've been at the bargaining table, and maybe I'm missing something here. Now, I'd also like to comment on the elimination of COLAs for retirees. I know that that's not, quote, in 2003, but I just want to comment on that. The COLAs for retirees were meant to maintain or to assist in maintaining the retirees' purchasing powers on into retirement. And, you know, we certainly understand the constraints of the budget right now. I spend half my life here and half my life in the budget hearings. We understand this. We understand that there's some challenges there, but we believe that there are a whole vast number of retirees who are not living but barely above poverty, and the COLA is really about the only thing that keeps them afloat. And we don't think you can just kind of unilaterally give it away or get rid of it. But I am concerned about the message that it sends to the retiring public employees, not those who are going to retire at a significant benefit, but those on the future who will not retire in a significant benefit. And so, you know, that's a concern to us. The reserves, I've testified about the reserves before, Mr. Chair. You know that we understand that the reserve decisions were made. You know, armchair quarterbacking, we all do it really well. We look back, hindsight, you know, my mom told me when I was a kid, hindsight's always 20/20. You know, when we made those decisions, when our organization supported the decision that the board was making, when the board made the decision, we had solid information from certified smart folks that told us we didn't need as much in reserve as what we had. We were arguing over how we were going to distribute the reserves when the economy went gunny sack and the stock market fell and, you know, crazy people flew planes into buildings. You know, this was not anything anybody anticipated. And now we have decisions that are considered to be contract rights. And our union does not have the authority, even if we wanted to, we do not have the authority as a union to hand to you the contract rights of our members and say, here, take them away. That clearly is a decision that needs to be dealt with through the courts. And again, win or lose, we're prepared to live with the decision of the courts, but we think that that's where the decision has to be made, and we think that's where it's going to be ultimately made anyway. And so we really need to think about that. The age of retirement. You know, I really thought about the paragraph that I wrote and thought about not writing it at all because I figured I would just really offend somebody if I suggested that seniors weren't as quick as they used to be. But I do want to say that I think that there have been compelling cases made before this committee, and I feel compelled to make the same case, and that is we represent hundreds and hundreds of public safety officials in this state. I don't want our public safety officials to be old. I'm sorry. I don't want them to be old. You know, if my house is on fire, I want young, energetic, strong, healthy firefighters crawling up that ladder, and I want to know they can carry my body out without help. I don't want to have to give them CPR when they get there. I don't want to have to call 911 and say I got a gasping firefighter on my floor. I need help. And you know what? When I pick up my phone, call 911. I want the operator at the other end of that line to be quick. I want her to think fast. I want him to think fast. I want them dispatching everything I need immediately. Now, having said that, we also have thousands of employees who just go to work every day. and push papers and answer phones and do the business of the public. And I think 30 years is enough. I think once they've done 30 years, regardless of their age, they ought to be able to get out. And I think they ought to be able to get out for a couple of reasons. One, we need the jobs for other people. And two, I want them spending their money in the system as a retiree. I want them helping us to build back our economy. And I think the only way you get your way, you build your way out of a recession is to get more people to work. And I think that's the fastest and the makes the most sense as a way to really rebuild Oregon's economy is to put more and more people to work. Now I'm going to set my written testimony aside and I'm going to say a couple of things because you know I've been cranky for 2 weeks about it. And I'm just going to say it. Private sector comparisons. God love them. And I do. And I think that they provide a valuable service to the state of Oregon. And I understand that not one of my members would have a job if it was not for the private sector. And the income that they bring to this state. You know, Entel, I love Entel. I wish we had 12 Entels. And I wish they would get their stuff back together again so that we could start growing our way out of this. But what I don't like is I don't like the idea of comparing the state of Oregon that has 40,000 plus employees to a corner shop with 10. If you want to compare the state of Oregon to an employer, then compare us to a large, diversified employer that has 40,000 employees, or at least more than 10. Don't compare us to Plaid Pantry with a 3% 401k that the employee may or may not be able to afford to participate in. Compare us to somebody who is of like size. Compare us to somebody who requires the kind of education that our people have to have. If you want to compare OHSU to another employer, don't compare us to a company that doesn't require college education. Compare us to a company that has doctors and nurses and scientists and people who get paid based on how many times they have been published with research information. Compare us equally. When we go into bargaining, we do not compare the city of Pendleton to Seattle. We don't compare the city of Portland to Burns. Compare us with equal-sized employers. Compare us to people who have the same kind of a workforce that we have, with the same kinds of requirements, with the same kind of longevity. Because I turn on a light or plug in a hairdryer does not mean I get to go inject my opinion in IBEW's negotiations or into their retirement system. Because I drive Fords and because my dad drove Fords and my grandfather drove Fords does not mean that the UAW ought to listen to me. And Ford Motor Company ought to ask me my opinion. You know what? We're all taxpayers. Every one of my members pays taxes every day. We're all in this together. And we're all going to build our way out of it together or we're all going to sink together. And I just think that, you know, there used to be an old saying in the lobby back when I first started, if you don't have a dog in the fight, stay out of the room. Well, you know what? I could argue that I got a dog in the fight on energy issues because I pay energy bills every month. But I don't go down there and weigh in on their battles. And you know what? We all pay taxes. And in this room, in this hearing room, and in the room with our employers, we're trying to work to find some solutions that work for all of us, not just some of us. And I just feel like it's, you know, isn't there a term in football or some sport about piling on? I feel like we're kind of being piled on right now, that it's everybody's got an opinion on PERS and nobody's going to make any changes in anything else till we change PERS. I'm saying that we're trying to help find some solutions. We're trying to help find some changes to PERS that everybody can live with. And, you know, with all due respect, some folks I just go back down to the other end of the hall and do their business and let us do ours and let us try to find reasonable solutions to very tough questions. So I hope I didn't sound cranky. I didn't mean to sound cranky. And I hope I didn't offend all of you, especially you, Representative Richardson. No, you were my biggest concern. Representative Butler left, so I have to worry about that.
I have a question, actually.
Representative Richardson?
Chair, Ms. Bykin, I have never heard you speak so eloquently. And, I mean, I understand that you represent 21,000 members of your federation, and recently we were considering a bill that would limit double dipping, and I've never heard anyone so eloquently speak in favor of that bill, because you said, I want quick, I want young, I want the jobs for other people. I appreciate that. I think that that bill ought to come back, because obviously if 21,000 people in your organization feel that we should allow jobs for others that are younger and more capable and more able and more quick, then certainly that speaks in favor of making those jobs available for them. And so, and although you may not have intended to speak on that, I appreciate you so eloquently giving us that opinion. Thank you.
Well, you know, every good deed goes unpunished. I have no response.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the contract rights area, I mean, I believe that if the court rules something's unconstitutional, if you and I have a contract with somebody, bargain a contract, that can go out the door. But it's also my understanding, though, that if we have a contract, I can't get city council or the legislature or anybody else to write a law because I don't like that contract and try to circumvent it. That contract supersedes, does it not?
As far as, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, as far as I know, I believe, I agree with you, I believe that's correct.
And I just wanted to say, on our way down, Representative Richardson and I were talking about public safety and age and discussing the thought of elderly firefighters coming up to the top of a building to carry us down to. So either great minds or shallow minds think alike, I'm not sure which. But, and the retiree...
aging minds think alike.
And the retiree question, that was one of the things, too, that we've talked about, where one of the arguments that, you know, we talk about it, people should retire, but then everybody, not everybody, but there's so many people seem to be not really retiring, but doing some fancy dance and then staying on, and so the younger people aren't getting the jobs and the older people are hanging in there and drawing their pension plus, and many citizens, of course, don't like that. I mean, they really view that as some kind of a double dipping, just the nicest word I can think of, and so I don't know the solution to that, because I know some people's circumstances change and they do need to get back in earning income again, even though they're retired, but... Anyway, well, I appreciate your testimony today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Other questions? Mary, I appreciate, you know, the fact that you've been here a long time and represent the people that you do, hardworking people, and I know they didn't cause this problem. Had some SEIU folks in my office yesterday, varying ages, varying times in state government, 10 years, 20 years. And so on. And my concern is this, is that we're about ready to have testimony that's going to tell us that the pension plan that they have is not secure. It's 66% funded. That the employer rates are going to be average 22.8% for the pickup. And that the system has an unfunded liability of $16.41 billion currently. That's the new projection. And it gets worse. It doesn't get any better. And I indicated to them that I think that the right thing to do for them, I mean, we're not just talking about saving taxpayers' money. We're talking about trying to right the system and save these people's pension. because it is my belief, and maybe you don't agree with it, but it's my belief that is, if we don't act boldly, give the court some opportunity to say either this is accurate and right and constitutional or it isn't, we are going to end up in some sort of a bankruptcy situation. I don't believe the taxpayers will bail us out. I think those who want new revenue in this building, if you don't solve this problem first, or at least have tried to solve this problem by presenting the court with opportunities, that many things will go badly here, not only this session, but in future sessions. And it will be a downward spiral. And so we're looking for cooperation from anybody and everybody, whether they come from business, labor, employer, employee. Doesn't matter to me where they come from. If they have an idea. One of those SEIU members had an idea. And I said, get it to me on paper. We'll try to run the financial model, see if it makes sense. And a lot of us are grasping at what it is that we can do. And I know the governor's office is doing that. I know that the House Democrats are doing that. Certainly, I've done that along with my Republican colleagues, some of whom served on the interim committee. And once again, for those who weren't here before, the new unfunded liability is $16.41 billion. Just like to reiterate myself. And the system is only 66% funded, but let me get back to what I was saying. We're deeply concerned. I'm concerned about those folks who are your members, who are working in prisons and working for DEQ and working for various agencies who aren't making huge dollars. We are concerned. I'm also concerned that, you know, when I see a PER statement that says that there's a teacher in Redmond who makes $48,000 a year and can retire in 6 years at age 58, making over $8,000 a month. You know, that doesn't seem somehow right. And I know how we got here. It was partly the crediting decisions that were made in the 90s, and as you said, we can 2020 that. But the bottom line is that money is no longer in the reserve where it should have been. It's in the employee accounts. And I don't know how you get it back out and how you remedy the situation, but we're looking for answers. House Bill 2003 presents some ideas, and maybe you don't agree that they're necessarily answers or that they're constitutional. But this committee, I believe, in order to do what I think we need to do this session, is going to have to institute a successor system, which you may or may not like, is going to have to present the court with some options as it relates to how we can write the system for Tier 1 and Tier 2 employees. And as our legislative counsel has said, that might be rather difficult, considering he thinks just about everything we would do to the system is unconstitutional based on how he interprets current law. But I guess I think that it would be better to try than to do nothing at all and just give up and say, well, we're just going to let the system go into bankruptcy. So that is my thoughts for the day.
Mr. Chair, can I just say that I can't speak for anybody but me. I have found that dealing with you has been a pleasure. And I don't want anybody on this committee to think that I am questioning your integrity or your commitment to finding answers to a really tough solution. You know, I think we're all really trying to figure out a way out of this, us included. And, you know, sometimes you just have to deal or play the cards you're dealt, you know, whatever. What we really want are new cards, and we don't have them. You or us. And sometimes you just have to kind of suck it up and say, we're going to fight about this and try and work out the pieces that you can. And, you know, I made a commitment to you early on in the session. That commitment is not wavered 1 minute, that I'm going to stay at the table for as long as there's a table to stay at and try and find some solutions that we can work our way through so that we can narrow the issues that we have to take to court. Because you know, and I know, that at some level we're all forced into the courtrooms. And probably the only people that win in the courtrooms are the lawyers. But, you know, at some level that's the only finality of an answer we're going to get. And, you know, I know that you have attempted with us to try and find a way to isolate the issues we can agree on and that we can resolve. And I think that we've done a pretty good job on some of those. But you also know that I have a moral and a legal obligation to sit before you and explain to you the position that our membership has. And, you know, you and Representative Kefouri do not have an easy time of it. And when you're all done, the other chamber gets to start all over again. So, you know, once you get finished with it, I just get to change players.
Well, the unfortunate thing, I guess, is that we really do have, I think, some timelines that we need to be aware of in order to meet to have an effect on the current budget. That doesn't mean that we wish to rush, but I think it does present us with a sense of urgency that we're going to have to make some decisions. So we're going to have to make them fairly quickly. But what I'm trying to do is give everybody the opportunity to bring every solution they can to the table and every thought that's available before we make those decisions. And as I say, that will be soon for the House. Anyone else want to bare their soul in committee today?
Thanks, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anybody else on House Bill 2003? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2003. I'm going to open public hearings on House Bill 2008, House Bill 2020, and call Jim Boyko, Steve Delaney.
Thank you, Chair Canope, members of the committee. I didn't come here to bare my soul, but I did come here to spill my data guts, I suppose. I'm Jim Voitko. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement System, and I've been asked by the Chair, as well as by the Chair of the General Government Committee on the other side of the Capitol, to keep those committees abreast from time to time of the state of affairs with respect to the financial health of the plan, particularly the UAL and the rate outlook and so on. So I am here with the assistance of our actuary, the PERS staff, and the Treasury staff to do so. Before reporting, I'd like to make three introductory points just so that you understand the numbers, some of which were already indicated by the Chair. And these points are very brief. First of all, these are estimates. They're not the result of full plan valuations. They are subject to fluctuation on a month-to-month basis as the capital markets go up and down. The point I'd like to make is that I would encourage the committee to focus on the overall financial picture that I'm about to paint and the most likely five-year trends I will report to you today rather than the month-to-month variations, which can either lead one to false pessimism or false optimism. The second point I'd like to make is that this is the most comprehensive data that we have available, and it is as of January 31st, 2003, just a few weeks ago. Those anxious to know precisely the difference that 7 weeks that have elapsed between that date today, what difference that would make, we'll have to await the next round of data. But I will tell you that over that period, only two factors can really materially change the figures I present today, and that is investment returns, the primary one, which were very poor in February, But the war rally has caused that to move back up. And pension liabilities, which in fact grow steadily month by month at a fairly predictable rate that's unlikely to create a major surprise in so short a time. So the third point I'd like to make is that in making this report to you, I might be a little bit confusing, so I want to start off on the right foot, and that is that when I talk about the unfunded actuarial liability, I'll be using what's called the mark-to-market basis. That means it's the actual market value of the assets that we hold in the trust fund. However, when I talk about the trends for employer rates, I'll be adjusting that somewhat in the short term being the next 4 years, to adjust for what's called the smooth basis for assets. It's a technique that has been adopted by the board, but it has one purpose only, and that is to gradually introduce either investment gains, or in this case, investment losses, into employer rates, and it does not indicate that the current health of the system is better or worse. The mark-to-market basis is the most realistic and accurate portrayal of that. So with that, let me give you three bullet points on the current status, which kind of sums things up. And the first one is that as of the end of January, the PERS unfunded actuarial liability had climbed to about $16.41 billion. The second point is that the PERS system-wide funding ratio stood at 66.6%. Let me explain what that means. If that number were 100%, it would indicate that we would hold at a mark-to-market basis all the assets in the fund necessary at this point in time to pay the actuarial liabilities that we have either accrued or anticipate accruing in the future.
Jim, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Is the 66 percent as low as the system has ever been in terms of its system-wide funding, or has it been lower at some point in the past?
Chair Canope, there has been one lower figure recorded over a quarter century ago of about 59%. I can't recall the exact date, but it was quite long ago, and it was when the fund was restricted by the legislature to only holding fixed income, so it's not a very comparable figure. The third bullet point is that the actuarially required employer rates that we would put into effect today, knowing the results up through the end of January, would be 22.8%. Now, let me explain the difference between the 16.5% roughly that you've heard that we have scheduled to go into effect on in July. Recall that that rate indicates all of the changes in the fund through the end of 2001. So that 16.5%, based on our current situation, I hate to say it, is actually too low. If we were to include the effects of 2002 and January of 2003, the rates would be 22.8% with smoothing. Now, so that's the current status of the key financial measures of the health of the system. Let me turn to the near-term outlook. We have not had an opportunity to run a number of what-ifs, but we did have the opportunity to project over the next 5 years what would happen with the January 31st, 2003 starting point, and on the basis that we would hit all of our key assumptions. The most important assumption in that is that the fund earned 8% from January or February 1st onward, and do so, in fact, with regularity each and every year. It's not a very reasonable assumption in the sense that investment returns never come with such unbelievable regularity. However, because it is our assumption, it is neither pessimistic nor optimistic relative to the actuarial assumptions adopted by the board. So it is what we would expect to happen if, in fact, the future were very monotonic, if you will. So if I could turn to, and I might also say that this does not include any of the legislative changes that you have made, for example, HB 2001, which has been signed into law, nor any of those that you have passed and that are working in the other body, and that would be HB 2004. But I think you've seen the estimates, the UAL and rate estimates of those, and you know that those are very material each in and of themselves, but they are still not huge by comparison to the financial footprint that's in front of us. So if I could turn to the outlook and ask the question, what would happen to the UAL that is $16.41 billion on an estimated basis as of the end of January over the next 5 years, we believe that the outlook is that it would grow, even if we earned 8% a year, to the numbers indicated in the table. That is, by 07, it would be about $17.8 billion. And we think that it would stabilize around $18 billion if we continue to earn that 8%. And then over the amortization period in the plan, about 26 years, it would gradually be paid off, and if all goes well, would be reduced to zero about a little over a quarter century from that date. If I could turn to the outlook for the funded ratio actually improves a little bit. And let me explain why the UAL can grow and the funded ratio, and obviously that's a bad direction in terms of the health of the plan, and yet have the funding ratio improve. The reason for that is higher employer rates, which I'll deal with in a minute. What the funding ratio indicates in its modest improvement from about 66.6% to 73% or so in 07 is that during this period of time, we anticipate a very heightened level of contributions from our employers. And those level of contributions would come in at a sufficient rate so that they would grow faster than the liabilities. So we think that the funded ratio could actually improve a little bit, and meaning that even an $18 billion UAL would be a slightly smaller proportion of the total fund than the $16.4 billion is today. If I could turn to the last one and answer the question, what is the outlook for employer rates? Again, this is where we move to using the smoothed basis, and you can see that in the 03, 04, 05 progression of rates. We don't immediately jump to the equilibrium 26.2% rate, but in fact the smoothing process moves us gradually up from 16.5 to 22.8 to 24.6 to 26.1 and finally to 26.2%. Again, this is on the same assumptions as everything else. We earn 8%, no new benefits, for example, the 26.2%, like all other rates that we report, are before pickup. So if we're dealing with an employer that also has pickup, their budgetary consequences are 26.2% plus 6%. I might remind the chair that these numbers are very, very consistent with those that we presented during the summer to the House Task Force on PERS, and also in that same task force when we presented our 50-year simulation. This is very consistent with the 25 to 30% rate levels that we projected at that time. That's the end of my testimony. I'd be happy to field any questions.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Boyko, I want to just make sure I understand some of these things. If PERS notices were sent to schools as of February 1st of this year, would that notice say, as of July 1st, you're going to be paying 22.8%?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, only if the board were to abandon its normal process, time process of rate making. The process by which we go through is typically a formal valuation. In this case, we had one for the plan through the end of 2001. That was available in the fall of last year, accepted by the board. The actuary then said these rates are consistent with this valuation and they would normally go into effect at the beginning of the next state biennium, which is July of this year. So that what we did was simply assume away the process and ask the question, what if we did a valuation as of the end of January, what would be the rate that would come out of it? That does not say that we would send the bill in July. It depends on what process we follow. But the financial consequences that the plan experienced through the end of January of 03 would cause the actuary to deliver a rate, an appropriate rate, that would be 22%. Is that helpful?
Follow up?
It is. Assuming that this goes on, as you have indicated here, but that because of the costs and other reasons, revenue shortfalls, a PERS employer reduces their employees by 10%. Will that affect these numbers at all?
To some extent, Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, there If you recall in some previous testimony, we've broken down the rate in various components. For example, there's a component for disability, there's a component for the normal costs of retirement, and then there's a component for the UAL. The UAL, once it's incurred, needs to be paid off, and it is somewhat insensitive to the number of employees that you have. So that portion of the rate, or at least a substantial piece of it, that reflects benefits already earned and must be paid, that what would happen then is that part of the bill would simply be set on a smaller number of people, and so the effective rate would go up if the employee base shrunk. The part that represents the normal cost of providing pension to each individual employee as they come into work each day would go down, not the rate itself, but it would be unchanged because it is every time a person comes to work, we take that much of his salary or her salary to pay the normal costs of providing pension. I know that was a complicated answer, but the bottom line is there are two parts to the rate. One part is relatively insensitive to the number of people. One part is very sensitive and must fall over onto the smaller paying population or contributing population.
Can you follow up?
Follow.
Okay, so it would make a difference as far as on paper is concerned, because if you had 10% fewer population in your of employees, then you still would have the same PERS liability, and so as a percentage it would go up.
That's correct.
Of payroll.
That's correct.
And then your assumption was based on an 8% investment rate of return since February 1st. Assume that we do better than we're doing now and that it's flat for year 2003. In other words, we don't lose anything, but we don't make anything, so it's 8% less than what these rates are based on. How does that affect that? Assuming that we don't, over the next 5 years, we may not even make 8%. So how does it? What is the effect of zero?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, the effect on the financial health of the plan would be very bad, because roughly speaking, our liabilities grow by about 8% a year. If the assets stay flat, that means we have another additional gap that needs to be added to the UAL and paid off. And I will say, Chair Canope, that within a few weeks we'll have the ability, as we did during the House PERS Committee, or House Task Force on PERS, to take these numbers and, in fact, do some what-ifs. We are rebuilding that model so that we could answer the question, what if over the next 5 years we are not 8% but 7.5% or 8.5%? And we could give you a sense of the consequences to the plan. But the bottom line is, if we earn less than 8%, and zero is a long way from 8% given the size of our plan, we develop a bigger internal indebtedness, i.e. unfunded actuarial liability.
One more?
Well,
okay. Mr. Chair, Ms. Boyko, because I'm not real positive about the rate of return for investments this year, would you give me a feel for what will be the cost to employers? I'm especially concerned about schools because that's what's kind of on my mind. What will be their bill for their PERS liability as of this July? If you know, when will these new figures take effect, and what would be the effect on the school district's payments or municipalities in the next year if we have a flat rate of return?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, the July rates that the board has passed and are scheduled to go into effect would be unaffected by a flat return in 03. However, the rates that we would then promulgate that would be actuarially required to fund the plan back to health in July of 05 would be larger than the ones that you see here. And I can't say exactly how much, but right now we're looking at a range of around 24% or so. If we did not earn 8% this year but instead earned zero, they would be higher, probably noticeably higher than that.
Okay, just
and the reason, and if I may clarify, the reason I picked July 05 is that under the current process, that is the time period, that is the time that rates reflecting the outcome, the financial scenario of 2002 and 2003 would then be sent out effect in a bill to participating employers. It would, the normal schedule would say what we're experiencing today is due to be billed to employers in July of 2005.
Okay, so my final question. If a school district's trying to determine what they're going to have to pay presently, is it like 18.48% that is a figure that they can rely on for starting July of this year, regardless of the new calculations?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, I believe that is the case. Now, remember, that's a system-wide average. So what they have to rely on is the precise rate that their particular school district or municipality received from us. But I would mention, as I've said before, it should be the highest number that they get because the board has instructed us to be prepared to revise those rates to reflect any completed legislative action by May 1st. Or thereabouts. And so we have set up and prepared to do that, and we know that we have one bill, HB 2001, that has been signed into law, and we don't know anything that you are working on that would raise rates. 2001 would lower rates, so I think in answer to your question, it's either that number or something less is what they should expect in July, generally speaking, system-wide.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pearson.
Mr. Voitko, on the projected contribution rates, we're, as I think everybody in the building is aware, we are facing a huge gap between what are the historical needs and resource levels that the state has had and what we have to cover those needs. And public service being generally labor intensive, so that if we have to implement even deeper budget cuts than we have already, and we shrink the public employee workforce, and if we, I'll just throw a number out, it's just for an example, 10% reduction in the active workforce, what is the likely impact on these contribution rates if we had that kind of shrinkage in our public employee workforce? That is, would these rates go up as a percentage of payroll 10% because of what you were explaining to Representative Richardson, I'm sure it's some lesser amount, but can we get a sense of magnitude about what the impact is? Is it nearly one for one that we have to fund a certain number of dollars, and if we are shrinking our public payrolls, it's going to jump up to maybe closer to 30%?
Chair Canope, Representative McPherson, I can't give you a precise answer, although with the permission of you and the chair, I'd be happy to answer by letter because I think that is a calculable number. And you are correct. It's not one for one, as I explained to Representative Richardson, but the size of the UAL is now a significant component of the normal rate. Our actuary looks at the normal rate in terms of 15-16%, and the UAL that we're seeing now is becoming a larger and larger portion of it because the normal rate is not going up to 26%. All that difference is the amortization of the UAL. So the higher the rate goes above the normal rate, the more the ratio that gets repositioned onto a smaller number of employees. And yes, the rate would go up. Would it go up to 30 under the current in the next biennium? I don't think so, but I'd like to actually do the numbers for you. The numbers will be much more accurate than my speculation, but we know the direction would be up.
Right. Mr. Chair, this is not so much a question, although I certainly would let Jim respond if he needed to. I'm sensitive to the need not to recalculate many times a range of variations, and so I think it may be that now is not the time to do that calculation, but I think that we should have, as we are shaping the next biennial budget, we should have an analysis about what the service level we go to will mean in terms of staffing levels and the implications of that for employer contribution rates, because I suspect that if the budget has the kind of curtailments that may result from that process, these rates here won't be reliable.
I would like to respond, Chair Canope, Representing McPherson, because maybe I wasn't entirely clear. They would go up, but they would not go up until July of 2005. And the reason is that once a rate is set, The actuary does not, we don't then react to layoff notices in Umatilla County or at the state DHS or any other place in terms of revising a rate. That's the rate that stays into effect for the full 2 years, even if they were to cut their workforce in half. What that means is that the flow of contributions would actually turn out to be less than the actuary estimated, which means that in July 05, we would have the consequence. So there would be a two-year delay in the effect that you just asked me about in your previous question. I believe that's the case, and I will double-check that with the actuary, but I'm pretty sure that that's the right answer.
Mr. Chair, if I could?
Yep.
A concern I have about the process we have is we already have smoothing rules in effect that have tended to defer the impact of the market losses we have already suffered. So we already know we have higher contribution rates coming down the pike, but we aren't charging for them yet because we have a smoothing rule that stages in that impact. And the dynamic you were just describing, where we don't take into account for another two-year period the impact of lower levels of public employment, if that is the result of the budget process, just puts us more deeply into the hole. So I think I would encourage all players in this process to exercise disciplines that don't just defer the impacts, because we've got a problem here that's getting larger and we've got to deal with it, and if we don't, it's good, it means we just pay more in the future.
Well, Representative McPherson, I have testified to our board that, in fact, this deferral, while it has its positive aspects, also has its costs. And its costs, one of the reasons that the UAL creeps up is that smoothing causes us to set rates slightly lower than they really need to be right now. And the only other thing, I don't want to leave behind a misperception. My business is not in how many or how few public employees they should be, but to the extent that you preserve payrolls in order to avoid a rate change, you don't really change in the next biennium what employers have to owe us with respect to the UAL, which is a number that is mostly insensitive to payroll. They owe us a dollar figure, whether they have big payrolls or small payrolls. However, if they have big payrolls and we earn less than 8%, then the pension accruals that will take place over that two-year period for the additional workers that have been kept on will, in fact, be not fully funded, because we will have not earned on those contributions our actuarial target. So, again, I'm not encouraging or discouraging staffing levels. I just don't want my explication of the mathematics to lead people to think that I've left a misperception on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else?
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it. Anybody want to testify on those successor bills today?
Nope.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2008. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2020. We will have some of the same bills up and hopefully have starting the amendment process next week on the successor plan bills and on House Bill 2003 and possibly other bills. I believe there are some things that we need to have costed out that PERS agency is doing for us right now. So we'll look forward to seeing some of those results next week. As for votes next week, hard to say.
You'll tell us at the last minute, though, I'm sure.
But I'll try to give you 20 to 30 minutes notice on both amendments and votes. And with that, committee, we're adjourned.